Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Austin and Jim, it's been several weeks since the attacks in India, and it looks like there's solid evidence now that the organization like that came out of Pakistan. What sort of repercussions is that going to have for Pakistan over the next year?
Well, because they both have nuclear weapons, not a whole lot. India uses the attack in Mumbai to make their case on an international forum that Pakistan is, as everybody knows, a hotbed of Islamic radicalism. I mean, just look at the numbers. In the last, since 2003, 14,000 people have died in Pakistan due to Islamic terrorism. Not just Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but, last year I think there were like 600 people killed in battles between Shias and Sunnis. And then there are attacks on Hindus and Christians who are small but supposedly protected minorities in Pakistan. In Afghanistan, the deaths have been running at about 6,000 per year. Pakistan has been the indispensable base for much of the Islamic radicalism in that part of the world. The terrorists based in Pakistan not only operate inside Pakistan, obviously, with that death toll, it was nearly 3,000 last year, but in Afghanistan and in India. And Pakistan refuses to totally accept that responsibility and to crack down. And the simple reason why they don't is because about a third of the population is Islamic conservative, and they're afraid they might have a civil war on their hands. But, India's pointing out that, what's coming from all of this Islamic support, tacit support for Islamic fundamentalism, is a civil war. So they're going to get it whether they want it or not. What do you think, Austin?
Jim, I think that we're seeing, you went right to the key point, the nukes put a clamp on really risky behavior between India and Pakistan. Recall, Dan, that column I wrote on Point right after the Mumbai attacks, that I said that you're
right.
Going to see over the next few months a rhetorical dance, but I thought India was positioned to use this terrible incident, as Jim said, to make the point demonstrably what India contends is Pakistan's involvement. It may be a fractured involvement by that, as fragments of the Pakistani government engaged in this, and particularly the intelligence services. But to make the point demonstrably, internationally, that Pakistan is at fault deeply at fault in these kind of terrorist activities inside India, but there would be some movement of troops, but there was going to be a great deal of transparency, and I thought the United States would play a role of an information guarantor so that everybody in Pakistan knows where the Indian troops are in Kashmir, on their Indian side of the line. Indians know where the Pakistanis are, and I think that has played out over time. Jim's reports on Pakistani troop movements, how minimal they were. One of the things that I had thought, the gambit on the part of Lashkar-e-Taiba and the Islamists, was that this attack would force Pakistan to withdraw troops from the Northwest territories and tribal areas. There looked to be a symbolic withdrawal. I think Jim published a piece saying that there were like 5,000 troops that had been moved, but it's not clear that they were necessarily withdrawn from active operations in the Northwest. I'm not sure where the troops came from.
Well, they did basically abandon the Swat Valley, which brings up another interesting point quickly, is that the Swat Valley, which is not far from Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, has for years been the hotbed of a relatively small group of Islamic radicals who want to impose a Islamic lifestyle on everybody in the Swat Valley. Now they burned down the only ski resort in Pakistan as part of that program. Skiing is apparently un-Islamic. And they're trying to shut down schools for girls. This is a very touchy point with most Pakistanis. Most Pakistanis want to send their daughters to school. The Islamic world has the highest illiteracy rate, especially among women, on the planet. Well, possibly with the exception of parts of Africa, which is a dubious distinction. And this is something causing the new elected the civilian government that came into power last summer in Pakistan to basically strike back against the Islamists, because the Islamists are basically hitting that one hot button that mobilizes the majority. We're talking, you know, probably 80-90% of Pakistanis. They don't want their little girls terrorized by these guys and told they can't go to school.
Well, that's that. What Jim just said actually has huge political implications within Pakistan, positive for the more secularists, let's call them more secularists than less secularists. In other words, what the Islamists are doing is once again enacted stupidity, fanatic stupidity on their part in terms of Pakistani domestic politics. But just to finish a thought, okay, Dave, that's where the troops were possibly pulled out of in order to send to the border. That wasn't a significant move on the part of the Pakistani government, Pakistani military, because the situation with India, that's an indication to me that the Pakistani government regards the situation with India as stabilized. Indians are not going to attack. Nukes are part of it, but also the Indians are getting from the Pakistanis at least some of their demands are being met. For one thing, the arrest of several senior Islamist leaders. Pakistan refused to extradite them to India. India made that demand, but Pakistan says we'll prosecute them. And interestingly enough, I think this was about 2 weeks ago, one of the senior members of the Indian Foreign Ministry said this may be satisfactory. You know, it was one of those little underwhelming statements that the Indian Foreign Ministry is quite capable of making. It's very much in the great British tradition, but it was one that's sending a message that was certainly, I'll bet this was diplomatically worked out with the Pakistanis. We'll say this, and that's going to give you the opportunity to prosecute these individuals that the Pakistani government, the Indian government, all know have been engaged in promoting terrorist activities against India, whether or not directly with the Mumbai operation. The association is, I would say, in my own mind, 99.99% likely, because of the way the Islamist leadership cadres are in personal contact with one another, certainly associated with one another. So you're watching the slow process, diplomatic process, but India, the Mumbai attack has given India diplomatic leverage, and the Pakistanis appear to be taking it seriously. Now, the domestic component. Let's go back to Dunnigan's point about let's not educate our daughters. That doesn't play well on the subcontinent. Remember, you're dealing with Indians. In Pakistan, you're dealing with Islamic Indians from the south, from the subcontinent. They want their daughters educated. That is another political force with inside Pakistan that the central government can use to mobilize opposition against the radical Islamists. So they've got the pressure from India. They've got international pressure because you've got to rein these nuts in, or you're going to end up in a potentially nuclear war with India. India's serious about this, but now you've got pressure, the domestic pressure, and the overreach by the Islamists. Jim, you said they burned down a ski resort. I missed that, but what an attack on modernism. You know,
exactly.
I don't think Mohammed had anything to say about
I don't think Mohammed ever saw snow.
I don't think he would have, you know, what does he care? But this to them is a you know, a symbol of, well, it's probably a tourist resort, and it's probably a place that people that we can't control make money, so let's burn it down. But that's an overreach, and it gives the government an opportunity to go with renewed force against these Islamist groups. It's going to happen quickly, or at least, but Pakistan, if they can get a hold of that element within their own government in the inner services intelligence
ISI
group, they could come out of this. The Mumbai tragedy could be in the long run a huge opportunity for stabilizing Pakistan.
Something else you have to keep in mind is the local politics. Now, in Pakistan, being the much weaker part of this India-Pakistan rivalry since 1948, they're very touchy about any hint of their government being bullied by the much more powerful Indians. I mean, Indians have more than five times the population and probably more than 10 times the military power. Now, the Pakistanis won't admit to that. But again, you look at our reporting on the build-up, so to speak, or the reforms, as it were, of the Indian and Pakistani armed forces. The Pakistanis are basically doing window dressing, whereas the Indians are doing substantial rearmament. You know, basically new equipment, new tactics, and new ideas, which the Pakistanis are not doing. So, as you described, the Indians played the diplomatic game with the Pakistani leadership's position in mind. In other words, they didn't make a big noise, you must do this. They simply said quietly, you know, look, we both have a problem with these bozos. In the past, there's been a policy in Pakistan of catch and release. In other words, they arrest these guys with great fanfare and then quietly, literally release, you know, most of these Islamic terrorist leaders, or only put them in jail for a few years. In Pakistan, they've had a long policy, especially when the military controlled the government, which they had for about a decade until last summer, of playing catch and release with the Islamic radical leaders. The new civilian government has apparently promised to stop doing that and to really put these guys away, at least the ones that, you know, don't get out of prison and run back to the tribal territories and then get hit by a hellfire. And India is apparently satisfied that the civilian government is actually going to do that. I mean, obviously, it's in the Pakistani civilian government's best interest to, you know, try and destroy or severely weaken the Islamic, terrorists. The other thing to keep in mind about local politics is of the 10,000 people who were killed last year by terrorism in the India-Pakistan-Afghanistan, it's about 10,000. Only 10% were in India, and 10-15%, and most of those were not Islamic terrorism related. Most of them were either tribal separatists in the northeast or communist rebels in eastern India. So from the Indian point of view, if you read Indian newspapers, yes, they will get very upset about a massive slaughter like in Mumbai. But by and large, they're winning in Kashmir. They've been defeating lowering the level of violence and basically killing and arresting more of the Islamic terrorists up there and shutting down the border more effectively with Pakistan. So the Indians see the Islamic terrorism problem as more of a Pakistani problem than an Indian problem. I mean, the Indian politicians have to pay attention to it because, you know, it's a democracy. And if you fall asleep on that subject, you know, your opponents in the next election will throw you out. But overall, the Indians have the domestic wherewithal politically to let the Pakistanis run with it. Now, the Indians know that NATO, you know, the entire West, so to speak, because you've got NATO troops in Afghanistan as well as American, are leaning on Pakistan big time. And lastly, Pakistan has enormous economic problems. You know, it's a corrupt society economically as well as, you know, politically. And the economy's in a mess. They desperately need financial relief. And the only place they can get it is from the West. So, again, this won't be mentioned openly, But you can be sure that this is being discussed when, you know, Western diplomats go to Pakistan to talk about terrorism. They probably start the talk with a lecture on, you know, what we can or cannot do for you to forestall economic collapse and all sorts of other ugly things that will spring from that.
Now, the Pakistan government's...
Dan, let me add a couple points to that real quick. One, I think... Jim, and I know why he says the Indian military is perhaps 10 times as powerful as the Pakistani military. I might say it's more, but in terms of being able to exert effective force, you know, Jim sketched out troubles in Nagaland and other separatist movements. India has multiple fronts, not that Pakistan doesn't. You've got the Baluchis, Northwest, and Kashmir, India as well, but... India's in estimating how much more powerful India is, you have to account for India's other security concerns. That said, India has an overwhelming conventional capability. Looking at its India's ability to use that force within 100 kilometers of on the other side of the Pakistani border. I don't mean going all the way through Pakistan, but you know, taking what would be politically and economically significant. The Indians could do it conventionally. And the question is, too, is how rapidly and effectively would the Pakistanis be able to respond with a nuclear weapon? Anyway, the point about that, the Indians have got that conventional military card huge. Secondly, the diplomatic point, just to kind of synthesize there, India has produced... diplomatically or convince the central government that it's a win-win situation for the Indians and for the Pakistani civilian government. Again, that's a long-term process, but for reasons that Jim and I discussed, we can see it happening. It's going on now. It's living history. Third, Jim talked about the Western economic pressure on Pakistan. India offers Pakistan economic opportunities. Like, don't write India out of that equation. A lot of them, you know, for, you know, the historical reasons and the military conflict, they're not fully realized, but there are plenty of sharp Pakistani business people and plenty of sharp Indian business people that understand that the Indian business community has a great deal can bring a lot to Pakistan in terms of investment. Of course, you'd have to have political modification in Pakistan to bring that about. But that's a carrot. Maybe it's a long-range carrot, but it's one that the central government certainly understands. Last of all, I think the Indian government, and Jim alluded to this, has done a good job of letting the anger play out in the Indian population. India's got a free press, in some ways a very free press. And the anger that after Mumbai was palpable. You could read the various Indian publications online, and it was just outrage across the Indian political spectrum. It's the kind of outrage that certain kinds of fringe organizations, and maybe not so fringe, the BJP, which is jump all over the issue, the Hindu nationalist party that they are. The government allowed that to happen. It's not going to stop it, for one thing. India is so internet savvy, the blogs were filled with it, but it allowed it to escape and moderate, and then they've shown enough success, diplomatic success, with the Pakistani government that they... If anything, the Indian government has bought itself a great deal, in my opinion, of political capital with the Indian people, because they're showing something is getting done, and they have portrayed it as the Pakistani problem it is. India's got to be the victim, but it's also a victim that with immense power to shape future events, and the government's done a good job of that.
Now, and something else that isn't understood in the West or appreciated in the West is the tremendous fear that Indians and Pakistanis have of the tribes, the Pashtun tribes. It's a particular problem in Pakistan, where about 20% of the population are tribal peoples, from the Baluchis in the southwest all the way along the Afghanistan border up to Kashmir, That's all controlled by the tribes, and since 1947, and for centuries before that, that area was ruled by tribal law. The government of Pakistan, by law established when Pakistan was established in 47, did not have government, you know, authority in the tribal territories. They had certain rights, and the area with the tribes, you know, it was an agreement between the tribes and the government of Pakistan. The tribes agreed to be part of the nation of Pakistan, but they did not agree to be ruled in all ways by the government of Pakistan. And until the last year, that law was agreed to. Now, the part of the deal was that the tribes would not raid. They would not make war outside the tribal territories. As far as the government of Pakistan is concerned, the tribes have broken that agreement. And the government, now this is a big deal in Pakistan. The government is going in there. Now, the people in Punjab and Sindh, the two major, you know, lowland, the core provinces where 80% of the population lives of Pakistan, have for thousands of years feared the tribes. Because those tribes were the people who, you know, whoever was invading, you know, what we consider India, and that would include Punjab and Sindh, basically gathered, you know, many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of warriors from the Pashtun tribes, which go from India, from Pakistan into Afghanistan, and went down and just ravaged, burned down, killed, slaughtered, you know, big mess. I mean, war after war has occurred, not every year, but, you know, every 100 years, whatever. They still tell stories about some of those things that took place, you know, 1,000 years ago. So there is a huge cultural memory of the problems you have with the tribes. So for the first time in over half, in centuries, really, the lowlanders are threatening the tribal territories. Now, again, in the West, you know, we don't appreciate that, but it's a big deal over there. The Indians are especially northern Indians, because the, you know, the invading armies really got down to Tamil Nadu, you know, at the southern part of India, but all of northern India has, you know, tell stories about the great invasions and all the Afghans, you know, the Pashtuns coming along with the invaders, you know, to join in on the fun, as it were. So this is an epical, you know, a watershed event going on there. The Pakistanis are doing nothing less than imposing government on the tribes. And that's a big deal. And unfortunately, most Pakistanis and a lot of Indians aren't sure if it can be done, because it's never been done. Well, actually, it hasn't been done since the Mongols came through. And that was a different time. You can't play, you know, governmental games like the Mongols did anymore. So, you know, given the fact that we have to be a little politically correct, you know, we can't slaughter, you know, 20% of a population in order to get the other 80% to calm down. There's a lot of uncertainty where that's going to lead. And along the way, it's going to be nothing but, you know, tragedy. A lot of people are going to die, and a lot of people are going to fear for their very lives if this epic, you know, event, you know, gets out of hand.
Where does the money come from to support the radicals? I mean, bullets aren't free. They've got to have money from someplace.
Well, two sources. The tribes have their own sources of income. The tribal governments and the warlords aren't always, you know, one and the same. It's basically 14th century up there. You know, it's medieval, literally.
Right.
Smuggling. There's some small industry, but basically they're very poor. You know, Afghanistan, which the tribal territories of Pakistan is basically a part of, is the poorest country in Asia. So they're just scraping by. I mean, there's farming, there's raising fruits and vegetables, but it's 14th century level industrialization, you know, economy, so to speak. Now, a significant amount of money, we're talking millions of dollars, not hundreds of millions, has come from Islamic charities in the Persian Gulf. And that has bought a lot of bullets. And basically, you can pay a young guy, if you can't get him to volunteer for free, $100, $200 a month, will bring him and his AK-47 out to fight for you for the summer, for the campaign season. And that's where it's coming from. The other big source has been heroin. 80-90% of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan.
Right.
And that is what's attracting a lot of Pakistani Pashtuns to go into Afghanistan, because they're basically being subsidized by the drug lords. I would say probably right now the drug lords are supplying more of the money to keep the Taliban going than the charities in the Persian Gulf, because the Persian Gulf states in the last 2 years in particular have been cracking down on that, the money going into that area, because the United States has been cracking down. Again, that's another very unpublicized area of the war on terror. It's been very important. For example, in the news recently, it came and it went very quickly, a crackdown on the 10 major Western banks. One of them paid a fine of $350 million. That's one bank.
Right.
Paying a fine of $350 million for laundering money for Iran.
Yes.
They also launder money, for Gulf Arabs, for all sorts of other reasons, including, passing money into Pakistan, into Islamic charities, who then give some to actual charitable operations, and other amounts of that money go to terrorists. And, the United States has proved that, even with charities, Islamic charities in the United States. But that's a big deal, and that's basically cutting off a lot of money they used to get. They've been getting for two decades now, more than two decades. But the heroin money is replacing it.
Now, are they getting much money from, like, Saudi Arabia? Because Wahhabism...
That was the charities. The Saudi religious establishment, 30 years ago, began an enormous fundraising and proselytization project, where they would go to mostly to Muslim countries, because they wanted to basically spread the Wahhabi version of Sunni Islam.
Right.
And they would build mosques, and they would basically pay for Islamic scholars, teachers, imams, and what have you. And a lot of this was purely religious. But once the Islamic terrorism started, and Wahhabism basically preaches that anybody who's not a Muslim is scum. And it should be killed. I mean, I've seen translations of some of the sermons that are still, or until recently anyway, I'm told, were being preached in Saudi, mosques. And this is hair-raising stuff. Very similar to the crap that's coming out of, Hezbollah and Hamas. Anti-Semitic, anti-non-Muslim, anti-infidel. And the Saudis basically said to the West, no, we're just basically subsidizing religion, the spread of religion. Islam is the religion of peace. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way. And the Al-Qaeda basically piggy-dogged on this, and all this hate preaching indoctrinated a generation of young Muslims to be suicide bombers and jihadis. That has now been exposed to a large degree, and even the Saudi, it took several years, and especially the Al-Qaeda starting to set off bombs in Saudi Arabia after 2003, the Saudis have finally agreed, about 3 years ago, to start cracking down on the fundraising, or at least to check, make sure it goes to just the building mosques and paying imams and not buying bombs and bullets, for the local Jamiah Islamiyah, in Indonesia, or the various other radical groups in Africa and in South Asia. So that is having a profound effect on operations in that part of the world. Doesn't get hardly any publicity, but a lot of the slack is being picked up by the heroin, the drug lords, which is a whole other, situation.
Right.
Dan, I realize we're running up on time. Let me just make one point out of
what
Jim said. What he described when he talked about the impoverishment in these areas and the level of development, this is an example of what the United States learned the hard way on 9/11, that these little chaotic or isolated corners of the world are very easy for some outside group with money, and it's comparatively little money. A few million dollars is like having several hundred billion dollars if you are in an isolated valley in the tribal territories. You are able to buy your own local militia, pay off the local tribal chiefs, impose your will by threat of violence, able to control the schools because you're paying for the schools, and whatever information you want taught, whatever version of history, whatever type of Islam, you're now in control. And there you've got a kernel of power, that if you are seeking special weapons, have committed to terrorists, you've got a position on the planet thanks to jumbo jets and or the international, quick international commercial travel and international communications for raising havoc intercontinentally. And what Jim described was, as he said, I forget the word he used, but piggybacked or doggybacked, riding it, is that you've seen this go on in not just out of Islamic charities. An example of a Hindu cult that took over a town in Oregon, I want to say about 20 years ago. Oregon. Recall that. They just show up with money. Now they're in charge, except in the United States you've got state and federal governments. You've seen this work out with other, here I'm playing with religious cults, but it goes on too with corporations. And I'll just as an example, and I shouldn't pick on Hollywood, use Hollywood as but the storyline of the big mining company that moves into the Western Valley and takes over the valley. They've got the money way out of proportion to comparative development of the rest of the valley. And what I just described for those of you who are Eastwood fans is Pale Riders, classic situation. That is where a outside well-funded or comparatively well-funded outside group with its own special interests is the ability to move into a impoverished area and use it as a base of operations. Now, Jim's given you some very good insight as to why one of the key sources for this particular, for the Islamist radicals, Saudi Arabia's changing its tune. It's taken a while. It's taken a threat back to Saudi Arabia to do it and to realize, and part of what the Saudis were up to was that they were exporting their own problem. Well, they can't export it anymore for a variety of reasons. For one thing, Kuwait won't let them do it. The United States won't let them do it. Iraq's emerging democracy, they use, actually in Iraq, Iraqi Arabs, and it's not just the Shias, I've heard Sunnis do it, use the term Wahhab as a term pejorative, meaning radicals from the Arabian Peninsula who come in to cause problems in, well, Mesopotamia, meaning where they are in Iraq. They use it as a pejorative. Now the Saudis have had to moderate it. It's going to take a long time to moderate it. It is cutting back on the funding, and now we have to face the other issue, which is the United States and Western Europe's own decadence vis-a-vis heroin. The opium demand is carrying the day for some of these Islamist radicals, because as the funding dries up there, they become narcotics gangs.
Right.
Well, again, you got to remember the reason why the heroin and opium trade ended up in Afghanistan in the 1980s was the Pakistanis drove it out of the tribal areas of Pakistan. They basically laid down the law and said, yeah, I know all you guys are getting rich with this stuff, but too much of it is ending up in the heartland in Punjab and Sindh. Iran, for example, has, I forget the number, 2 million addicts, and that's Afghan opium. Opium is cheap. Heroin's a little more expensive. You send that west, to Europe where they can afford it. But basically, this stuff becomes a local problem in that part of the world. And it's becoming a problem in Afghanistan, where in Kabul you have an opium addiction problem. Young men, and especially young men, but including some young wives, this is one way to deal with the problems of life. And the government doesn't like it because it can happen to their own kids. Talk about bringing, the war home.
Right. Well, I guess we've run out of time again, gentlemen. And it, as always, interesting discussion, and we'll talk to you next time.
Okay.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Take care.